Today, two beautifully written memoirs that stir hope as we all confront the losses of our ecosystems in crisis. First, we talk with William DeBuys about The Trail to Kanjuroba, Rediscovering Earth in an Age of Loss. Then, a moving memoir about farming in the old way and bringing it back. We talk with James Rebanks about his award-winning book, Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When conservationist and author William DeBuys was invited by Zen master Joan Halifax to go to Nepal on a medical mission, he leaped at the chance to see a region gravely threatened by ecological disruption. It could be a last chance for him to see things as they have been for millennia before they change. What he discovered was a way to hold both joy and grief simultaneously. Joy at the beauty of the natural world, the human exchange with the Nepalese, and the opportunity to practice care for both people and the planet. But always the undertone of grief in this age of loss. Bill McKibben called DeBuys one of the planet's great observers, saying that The Trail to Kanjuroba may be his masterwork. DeBuys is the author of 10 books, including A Great Aridness, which we spoke with him about in 2012. William DeBuys, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
The Trail to Kanjuroba, Rediscovering Earth in an Age of Loss. This was a title that immediately grabbed my attention because I struggle with a sense of loss every single day. And I know I'm not alone, but it is wonderful to come across a book like this that doesn't really focus on the loss, but also does not turn away from it.
Oh, thank you. That's exactly how I hope people will react to the book. So many of us suffer from environmental grief these days, and this book was born out of my own sense of grief. In a sense, it's the third book of a trilogy that began with a book on climate change, which was called A Great Aridness, followed by a book on extinction and biodiversity loss called The Last Unicorn. And I went on the journey described in this book seeking some kind of solace for my environmental grief after having spent so much time looking at climate change and the war against wildlife.
Yes, and I believe we did speak with you about that first book, The Great Aridness. You know, I have a quote on my email by Wendell Berry. It says, "Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts."
Perfect.
So you went to Nepal with a volunteer medical expedition. Tell us about how that expedition came about.
Well, a good friend of mine is the abbot of the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe. Her name is Joan Halifax, and I knew her long before she was recognized as a Roshi, a venerable teacher. And Joan, or as we call her now, Roshi, has been organizing expeditions and mainly pilgrimages at the beginning to parts of Nepal and Tibet since 1980. How many years is that now? 30-some years, or 40-some. 40-some years. But she's been doing this for such a long time. And in the aftermath of those two books that I just mentioned, she said, "Why don't you come with us to Nepal and join one of our Nomads Clinic expeditions?" And after some hemming and hawing, I decided, yeah, that would be just the right thing to do. So away I went.
And you went kind of in the footsteps of Peter Matheson, who is also who was the Roshi of the Zendo that I attend here on the Ocean Zendo on Long Island. He went in a reverse order from you, but talk about the inspiration he also gave you with his book, The Snow Leopard?
Well, that was a reason I went on this expedition, because I knew we would be traveling the same trails that Peter Matheson traveled in 1973 with a remarkable human being, George Schaller, one of the foremost conservation biologists in the world. And as it happens, George is a friend of me, and Peter is someone I knew rather slightly. But more to the point, when The Snow Leopard was published in 1978 in the New Yorker, it just knocked me over. It was one of the most inspiring pieces of writing I had ever encountered in my life. And it sort of helped to solidify my ambition to be a writer and to be a writer of a certain kind of work. And so Peter has always been in my pantheon of truly great writers.
Yes. So Joan Halifax, or Roshi, told you that her secret plan was to help the Western doctors on this expedition change their focus from cure to care. What did she mean by that?
She meant that instead of approaching medicine technocratically as the application of sophisticated drugs and therapies and diagnostic machines and techniques, that the first thing to do was always to make connection with the patient, to attend to the human being in front of you. And care over cure has an additional meaning in the context of the kind of medicine that we practiced in Nepal, because those sophisticated therapies weren't available. We had no access to x-rays or blood work or scans, let alone surgeries. And so whatever was going to happen between clinician and patient would happen in the context of that one-on-one relationship. And the best thing that we could do in many instances was just to care, was just to connect and warm hand to warm hand to provide support and comfort.
And when you also talk to from cure to care, you talk about the idea of hospice for the earth. You know, when I first read that, before you explained what you meant by that, I got this shudder, you know, oh my God, hospice for the earth. So tell us what you mean by that.
Well, one of the reasons I went on the expedition, I wanted to see the values and ethics of the clinicians in practice, so that I could reflect on whether those values could be applied to environmental care. And those values, the care over cure approach, is really the central value of hospice care and of palliative care, which is to say, make the present moment as good as possible. Prioritize care over cure, and try not to become too attached to what the ultimate outcome of things is going to be. Focus on the now, make it good. And I was wondering if applying those ethics to earth care might be somehow effective in earth care, but also liberating for those who provide the care. I've been in environmental work all my adult life, and burnout is a common problem for all of us in this profession. And I thought maybe we could approach things with a lighter heart with that set of values.
Could you talk more about that? I mean, what does that mean particularly? What would change in the work of caring for the earth if we applied that notion? Give us some examples.
Well, I think the examples would come from specific situations that are really hard to predict or evaluate in the abstract. The main thing is the change of heart in the practitioner, not trying to fix everything, but to try to improve matters for the time being, for all the participants in it. In a broad policy statement or context, perhaps what would be meant might be that instead of expensive seawalls to deal with sea level rise, one might engage in a managed retreat and care for the people who are displaced by that retreat. But really, I think the important distinction here is really just in the mind of the caregiver. You know, the data on hospice care is that people in hospice tend to live longer than people who reject hospice and elect to pursue dramatic therapies. That's kind of Zen, as Atul Gawande says, that the best way to live longer is not to try to live longer, but to live in the moment. And it happens, too, that the data on hospice caregivers shows that they have half the rate of depression that intensive care personnel tend to have. They last longer. You know, their endurance holds up. They avoid burnout better. And in all of this context, I think it's important to say that hospice for Earth doesn't mean that Earth is dying. Aspects of the creation in which we live are certainly dying, but Earth is going to go on producing life, producing forms more most beautiful and most wonderful, to quote Darwin, forever and ever until the sun burns out. Life is inherent in Earth, and it will not be extinguished by whatever we do as humans.
Yes, I know that, but I struggle with that because the creation that we have lived in is so beautiful, so ineffable. I mean, we are part of it, but so are all those wonderful creatures who have had nothing to do with what we're doing to this planet. So while I take comfort in the idea that life won't end, there's still the grief and the tragedy of all the beautiful creation that we don't have to destroy, that it could be completely different. We could, in fact, steward it.
That's exactly right. And in a sense, the situation obliges us to keep two different scales of time in mind at the same time. We really are destroying the creation of which we are a part, and all those myriad marvelous life forms. This is the most glorious creation yet in the history of our planet. The diversity is simply extraordinary. It's one of the most beautiful achievements of the entire universe. I mean, you have to say that. The idea that life will go on, well, yes, but that's life going on at a geological time scale. And in the meantime, we are losing so much. And so one of the points to which I arrived in the book is this imperative for us to build arcs. And I use the word arc as a metaphor. We need to build metaphorical arcs to set sail out into the ocean of the turbulent period of climate change and diversity loss that we have created, in the hopes that some of these arcs will get to safe harbor on the other side. The more arcs we build in the form of parks, refuges, you name it, the better the chance that at least some of them will get through to the other side.
Hmm. Yes, I'd like to come back to that later, but let's go back to your journey. You write that every day on the trail becomes a kind of pilgrimage. Where did you go, and how was it a pilgrimage?
Well, we walked about 150 miles in Upper Dalpo, which is behind on the north side of the main Himalayan range, the highest mountains of the Himalaya, in a sort of desert mountain area, still with many high peaks, wedged between the highest part of the Himalaya and the Tibetan plateau. And we made a big circle within that area. And one of the places we went to was She Gompa, the monastery or the refuge at She, which was also the chief object and destination of the expedition that Peter Matheson and George Schaller made in 1973. And along the way, we fell into a kind of rhythm. Every morning began with meditation and a little bit of a talk from Roshi. And we were urged to view our entire trip as a pilgrimage and to view each day as a mini pilgrimage within that. And that became sort of an organizing principle in the rhythm of our days and imparted to me part of the answer to dealing with my environmental grief that is expressed at the end of the book.
And what does a pilgrimage mean to you?
A pilgrimage means to be focused on the goal of the pilgrimage in all actions on the journey. If you're a pilgrim, you can't not show up. You have to take seriously your journey, your steps. And for me, the pilgrimage was about how to live, in what way, and why. And I don't think there are any questions more sacred than those. And so that was part of how I tried, at least, to focus my mind as I went along on the journey. And it gave me support in the hard times and focus at all times.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with William DeBuys about his newest book, The Trail to Kanjuroba, Rediscovering Earth in an Age of Loss. So one of the ways in which the care that this medical expedition gave, and I'd say also very apt to the notion of pilgrimage, was embodied in foot washing. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, not least because all this talk of pilgrimage and so forth might make the book seem like a heavy trudge. But actually, it was a very joyful experience, and never more so than in the washing of feet. It turned out that nearly all or most of our patients in the clinics had a lot of aches in their knees and hips and sometimes shoulders. And these resulted from a lifetime of carrying heavy loads up steep slopes. So these people would go to the acupuncture tent for relief from those aches and pains. But before they went to acupuncture, they had to have their feet washed. And that task was taken on by non-clinicians like myself. And so for several days, I found myself on my knees, washing the feet of Tibetan people, mostly women, who thought the whole situation was absolutely hilarious. And indeed it was. Roshi loved the tableau of these rich Westerners, rich by definition, because they had traveled halfway around the world to get there, washing the feet of Tibetan peasant women with its biblical overtones and joke telling and constant comedy. So this was something that allowed us a connection to people that was just extraordinary. One of my favorite passages in the book is an interlude, a moment when somehow I connect with the woman whose feet I am washing in a way that I might never have expected or been able to do in any other context in any other place.
I mean, you say it was hilarious to them, but it also led them to trust you in a way that they might not have otherwise.
That's right. After the foot washing episodes had taken place and we were back in Kathmandu, Roshi checked in with Dolpo Tolku Rinpoche, the highest lama of the region, and he gave her some feedback on the foot washing. He said, like all the villagers, he thought it was an extremely weird and strange thing for us to have done, but also like them, he assented that it distinguished us and it convinced them that we were unlike other Westerners, and namely that we were trustworthy.
So why did you have to wash feet?
Well, the nitty-gritty of this is that, and nitty-gritty is the right term, is that the unwashed feet in the acupuncture tent made working in there intolerable. The stench was just awful on a hot day. And on a cold day, when the flaps of the tent were closed, it was even worse. And so just for the sake of sort of sparing the clinicians from the odors, we washed the patient's feet. And that was also good from the standpoint of having clean sight for needle insertion as well. I should add that people in Dalpo don't have the luxury of washing very often, and they may, in some instances, never wash their feet. So we encountered some very interesting feet and toenails along the way.
Now, another thread in the warp and woof of this book is plate tectonics. Why? First of all, tell us, what are plate tectonics for those of our listeners who may not know? Why did you include that in this book and so prominently? Why is it part of the story?
Well, there are two scientific stories woven into the story of the expedition through Dalpo. One scientific story is the journey of Darwin as he developed the theory of natural selection. And the other scientific story is the story of the development of the theory of plate tectonics. Now, the plates involved are the plates of Earth's crust, including the continental plates. And here we were walking on the Himalaya, which is the result of the India plate crashing into the Eurasian plate and pushing up that dramatic mountain range. The reason to include these two scientific stories in the book is that the book begins from this paradox. Thanks to those two theories, we sapiens, can tell ourselves the biography of Earth without resorting to magic. We know how our planet formed, how we evolved on that planet, where we are in the cosmos, what all the life around us, how it came about. Our omniscience is not perfect, but it's pretty substantial. And plate tectonics, as a body of theory, was developed primarily in the 1950s and 60s, confirmed by the late 60s, so that my generation, I grew up at that time, is the first to have the benefit of that point of view. We humans have achieved our near omniscience within the lifetimes of the oldest people among us on the planet today. And at the same time, we are near to destroying the creation of which we are a part. So that is the astonishing paradox. Here we are, this node of self-consciousness, well-informed, realistic self-consciousness within the vastness of the universe, and we're wrecking the world around us.
You know, I want to say one thing about how we frame that we are wrecking. And I think of Greta Thunberg. That's another quote that I have on my email, where she, I don't have it in front of me, but she basically says, it's just a small group of extremely powerful men and corporations who are destroying the planet for their own short-term profit. And I think that's the struggle, because today, just before this interview, you know, we have this budget reconciliation bill. We're doing this interview on August 31st, a $3.5 trillion bill that will include game-changing help for the climate. And today I read in the news that the most powerful corporations in the country are marshaling all their huge resources to do everything they can to gut that bill of anything that would help the climate or anything else. Fossil fuel companies, Apple Computer, all the usual suspects. And yet, well in excess of 70 to 80% of the American people desperately want it to pass. So when we say we have to think a little bit more precisely about who is really doing this, and then what is our responsibility to push back?
Well, I think that's right. But you know, we are all complicit in the terrible problems that the planet faces. I've been in small communities in the forests of Laos, for instance, and there the war on the biota is in full swing, and some very, very poor people are involved. Certainly the white male cabal of corporate leaders and so forth are most guilty in this, but really every American is part of, or nearly every American is part of this, because we consume at such a high rate around the world. And our whole set of values globally about improving the lot of the people across the earth is predicated on raising the standard of living in all parts of the world. Frankly, our poor planet can't take it. So, yes, we can point the finger at some real, honest-to-goodness villains. And yet, eventually, we have to recognize that we are all part of this, too, and resolve to be less inert, to be more proactive, to be more committed to change. We don't have any other choice.
And in this book, William DeBuys, in The Trail to Kanjaroba, toward the end, you talk about hope. You say we cannot hope to return to how things used to be. But you say that hope has other meanings. And you quote Barbara Kingsolver, who's one of my favorite novelists, who's written climate fiction. She says that hope is a mode of survival and a mode of resistance. So tell us how you experience hope and how it motivates you.
In the end, my hope is really very close to the ecological concept of surprise. And it so happens that that's true for what Barbara Kingsolver writes about hope as well, that in complex systems, we can never know the future. Things happen that seem to come out of the blue. Those surprises can be negative or positive. The duty of us with hope, hopefulness is to keep oneself in a state of preparedness to render the effects of surprise as beneficial as possible. An example I give in the book is Vaclav Havel, who for years and years had no idea whether the Soviet Union would crumble during his lifetime or not, but he was resolved to be prepared to step in with his colleagues if the Soviet Union faltered, and to push and strive and make sure that whatever decline the Soviet Union experienced, that they would make that as positive as possible for the Czechoslovakian people. The same may be said of Nelson Mandela, who never knew if apartheid would crumble during his lifetime. But he held himself in readiness to make that surprise, that collapse of apartheid, as beneficial as possible when it did finally occur. So those are the models of hope in my world.
Well, this is such a powerful book and a beautiful book and many, many stories within it that really capture the hope that you're talking about. The Trail to Kanjaroba, Rediscovering Earth in an Age of Loss. William DeBuys, it has been a privilege to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Francesca, I'm very, very grateful.
William DeBuys. Go to writersvoice.net to see photos of his journey to Kanjaroba. Next up, a farmer goes back to the future with his book, Pastoral Song. Stay tuned after the break. That was A Pastoral Song by Haydn, sung by Ellie Ameling. When James Rebanks was a kid, he didn't want to follow in his father's footsteps in the family business of farming. Until, that is, his grandfather stepped in to awaken in the boy a love for the natural world and the stewardship of it. His grandfather farmed in the old way. Rebanks writes that he was a boy living through the last days of an ancient farming world, where the farm animals, local wildlife, and his grandfather were part of the same whole. Then his grandfather died, and his way of farming on the land died with him, for a while. Rebanks's father tried to farm in the new industrial monoculture way, with disastrous results. When Rebanks inherited the farm, he revived his grandfather's legacy and brought the land back again to wholeness. He chronicles that journey in his beautifully written memoir, Pastoral Song. The great nature-writing legend Wendell Berry said, James Rebanks's story of his family's farm is just about perfect. It belongs with the finest writing of its kind. Rebanks is also the author of a best-selling earlier memoir, The Shepherd's Life. James Rebanks, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
So this is just a beautifully written book and a really compelling read, a Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey. You begin the book with a memory of being on a tractor with your grandfather. Tell us where you were and why you start the book there.
Okay, so I was somewhere between 7 and 10 years old. It was a recurring scene in my childhood, being in the back of the tractor and plowing a field. So it could have been any of those ages. But the reason I started there is two or threefold. So it was one of my clearest memories of thinking about what my grandfather was, what a farmer was. I remember being in the back of that tractor that day. And trying to make sense of it, really. What were we and how different were we from other people? And why was he like he was? And what was his relationship with the birds that followed the plow? I remember I was probably very bored for lots of hours behind him behind the tractor seat that day. So that's a sort of really important early memory for me. But then it has a symbolic value as well, because we're increasingly learning that plowing, which once seemed like this benign activity that humans had always engaged in, is now at the heart of debates about how we should look after the land. So later in the book and later in history, of course, we've come to realize from soil scientists that disturbing the ground plowing, something that seemed like a really benign good thing or necessary thing, is now kind of problematic. And that scene is symbolic of something from my childhood which seemed fine, which is now questionable. And the world has changed. So I wanted to go back to a moment where that was a more innocent thing.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you say that, because much of the book really actually, much of the book that deals with your grandfather's farm and how he farmed, is about the more benign ways of farming in the past. And I remember when I read this description of plowing, I also had this little ouch moment because, you know, as you say, we're learning that disturbing the soil is not so great and people are employing no-till methods now. And yet there was so much else in which, you know, your grandfather really was clued into the connections, all the connections, not just between the farm animals and, the crops he was raising, but all the other animals, the wildlife, and all the connections of nature. So talk a little bit about how your grandfather farmed.
Yeah. Okay. So I think all of that's true. So yeah, in my childhood, when I first began to pay attention to these things, my grandfather was an old-fashioned, he didn't call anything by sort of complicated names, but I now realized it was a rotational farm. There's a bunch of different things happening in different fields, a bunch of different kinds of livestock grazing in different ways in different places, and it was rotational. So he never did the same thing in the same field twice. So all of those different activities, the corn, the oats, the hay timing, the hay meadows, they're all revolving, or everything except for the hay meadows, which is semi-natural grassland is rotating, and there's a kind of dance happening there. Certainly on the ploughed bits of the farm, he said the fields dance around the plough, and that basically is a pattern which evolved right from the earliest agriculture when we first began to till and plough fields. We know from Virgil and other ancient farmer writers that they knew that you couldn't do the same thing over and over again on the ground. You had to mix it up. You ideally needed livestock or rest in the rotation. And there was something magical about that which mended the soil. And we now know what that is. That's photosynthesis and roots and soil biology and all that stuff. But my grandfather or an ancient Roman farmer in Virgil's book, The Georgics, didn't have a clue why, but they did know that you needed to do it. So my book really tells the story about growing up in the 1980s and 90s on what was by then quite an old-fashioned farm and being in the tail end of an agricultural tradition, I think, which lasted from before history right through to maybe the 1960s or 70s on a lot of modernized land, and which only really hit my family in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. So I was a sort of child witness, really, to the end of an older kind of farming. And, you know, after that, things happen which fundamentally change that, which mean that you can grow only one crop. You can keep only one kind of livestock, and you can have monocultures and specialization in a way that wasn't possible before that.
Did your grandfather actually say that the fields, what did you say, the fields dance around the plow?
Yeah, so he did. He was trying to teach me. So the first third of the book is my grandfather trying to take me under my wing, because I was a 1980s kid, basically, 1970s, 1980s kid, and I would probably have rather watched TV and movies and all sorts of other things than go outside in the rain and work on a farm. But my dad kind of alienated me a little bit. I had like a tough dad that would sort of shout and things. Not a bad dad, it turns out later on he was a good dad, but he was quite tough at that time. And my grandfather realized that maybe I was not getting pulled into the farm. So the first third of the book is about my grandfather taking me under his wing and starting to teach me what all these things mean. And so, yeah, he was explaining to me how the farm worked and why it worked in those ways, and trying to make me fall in love with it, I think. And maybe the nicest bits of the first third of the book are that ultimately he succeeded in that. I went from being quite a reluctant farmhand to somebody who by the end of that year was starting to see the world in the way that he wanted me to, because he'd shown me how to read it and how to see it was beautiful.
Yes, and it is a beautiful turn of phrase, the fields dance around the plow. You know, there is a poetry in this book that not only do you have, but one can see it, you inherited it as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. So a lot of the people that I grew up among were in no way literary. They were just working, northern working people in England. They did have they love to tell stories. They still do love to tell stories, even the ones that don't think of themselves as literary or storytellers. So there was a very strong tradition of telling you the stories of the fields or the men or women that had worked in the fields. And they were always, as they worked, they were always telling each other stories as well. But there was also, and I think there is in a lot of non-literary ordinary working communities, there was also, to my ear anyway, a kind of poetry to the way that they spoke, and a joy in, okay, quite simple language, but there was a sort of joy in how you spoke about things. And yeah, so I was very aware when I was growing up that that telling a story was a skill, probably a skill you told in the pub or while you were working in a field, not rather than in a book. But yeah, that there was the ability to tell a story or to make everybody laugh or to make everybody remember a thing that had disappeared, that those were skills that my grandfather had and my dad to an extent. And yeah, I think I was a teenager before I fell in love with books, really. And the quite cool thing was when I read my first great books, novels or poetry or whatever it was, quite soon after I read them, I remember thinking, hang on a minute, we do this. We just don't think we do it. And that was quite exciting for me, because I thought, oh, hang on a minute, maybe I could do this book thing. maybe the way that my granddad speaks or the way that they tell stories, why wouldn't that make a great book? And then I would read people later on. I would read people like Tolstoy talking about his childhood, And okay, he's a magician, a wonderful, wonderful classical writer. But I remember reading it thinking, there's not such a great difference between his family stories and my family stories. Why not? Why not? Why could I not have a try at this thing?
Yes. You know, I mean, we'll get back to the farming, but I have to say, you were an indifferent student, I read, but then when you were 17, you suddenly got a passion for books. What turned you on to books?
So boredom turned me on to books. So we only had one TV. We actually had a second TV, but it was in like the posh room. I don't know if that's a thing in America, but in English households in the 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s, there was like a posh room that you never went in except for at Christmas. So there's one TV in there. The other TV's in the kitchen. And my dad would be like so tired after work that he would basically fall asleep in front of the TV, but he'd have the controls in his hand. And if you change the channel, you would get shouted at that he was watching that. So what do you do when you leave school when you're 15? You can maybe go out to a pub or something, or go and see your friends one night a week or something. The rest of the time, I didn't know what to do when I finished work. So I started picking up books or sort of looking at my mom's bookcase. Turns out that she'd inherited a lot of amazing American, French, Russian books from the sort of 100 years before that, particularly from the 1950s and 60s. So literally like the first three or four books I read when I began to love reading were things like The Old Man and the Sea by Hemingway, or The First Man by Albert Camus, which is still one of my favorite books, or there was some really beautiful nature writing in there, like Tark of the Otter by Henry Williamson, which is like a classic of English nature writing. So I didn't realize it, but I went from terrible student who'd bummed out of school to farm laborer to closet literary obsessive within about 6 months.
That's great. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James Rebanks. He is a farmer in the Lake Country in England. His book is Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey. So let's get back to the farming. You've talked about the diversity, the rotational farming. What does diversity mean, or what did diversity mean on your grandfather's farm?
So basically the way that most of rural England worked is that everywhere did everything, if that makes sense. So whether you're in the south of England or you're in the mountains in the north where I live, everybody grew some of the crops that they needed in winter. Every district would have had dairy cattle. Every district had beef cattle. Every place had sheep, and everywhere grew multiple different crops. So you have really quite an ancient pattern there. So if you're And all of those little fields, because it was little fields, were divided up by dry stone walls or hedgerows, which are basically thorn trees that are managed by people, are periodically managed so that they're like an impenetrable barrier between the fields. And if you think back to like a sort of picture postcard image of rural England, that's what you're looking at. You're looking at lots of crooked fields that have come out of deep history. They're all quite small. They're divided by hedgerows. There's quite a bit of woodland in there. And that's like that because that's how it came out of the deep past. That's how people cleared the woodland. That's how they just struggle to make a living in the way that ordinary people do. But we now know, if we sort of turn this into ecology, we now know that that was creating all sorts of habitats for things to live in. So when that stuff starts to disappear, because we basically start copying in America after the Second World War, because you're richer than we are, you have all the sort of technologies and chemicals we haven't yet got, they very quickly come across into our farming, and we think this must be progress, right? You make the fields bigger, you rip the hedge out, you get a tractor instead of a horse, you then get a bigger and bigger tractor with every passing year or decade. And, oh, wow, you can control the weeds. You use this DDT stuff, or you use these sort of insecticides or herbicides. Every single bit of that seems like it's progress. It comes from somewhere more advanced than us. We assume that people have thought it through properly. And yet what we now know is that I was as a kid, I'm living through the end of that patchworky landscape that lots of birds, lots of insects, bees, butterflies, etc. could live in, is about to be transformed in an attempt to copy the American Midwest. it's about to become a landscape in which the hedges disappear, often the walls disappear. We go from maybe five crops on a farm down to one crop, or we go to just one species of animal, like sheep that are grazing all the time, or beef cattle, or we go to super big dairy herds trying to produce commodities for a global sort of globalized agricultural market. And the reason I wanted to tell this story is that the evidence in the UK now ecologically is that this is one of the greatest disasters that's ever happened to the English countryside. It goes from a not perfect place, but a place with lots of niches, lots of habitats where things could live, and a sort of crafted, handmade landscape, to something that's trying to copy the American Midwest, even though it's ecologically unsuitable for here. And the birds are disappearing, the insects are disappearing, and there's now grave concerns about what we're doing. And of course, we've learned that we've been trashing soil. And yeah, I suppose where this gets really interesting, now that my book's been published in America, is we sort of know those things are true in America as well. And so what I tried to do is reflect a mirror back from somewhere very far from America, back onto that age of optimism and innocence and belief in simple belief in progress, and maybe question it. I was going to say question it a little bit. We're probably questioning it a lot and say, whoa, hang on a minute. We've known increasingly since the 1960s, when people like Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, that this is not simple, that this is, we've been trading away stuff, and we've been saying it's fine, that it makes food cheaper. We've been encouraged not to think about it, encouraged to let farmers do the work and be out of sight and out of mind. And we now know this is a pretty disastrous way to deal with food and farming and nature.
Yes, we're facing an insect apocalypse, which would be apocalyptic for all of us because they're the basis of the food chain. And that goes back to, you know, your grandfather believed that everything was connected, everything on the farm. You say these new methods actually make it impossible to make those connections, impossible to assess the impacts. And I was really struck by one example, the curlews. I don't know if we have curlews in North America, but tell us about the curlews and what happened to them and why.
Okay, so in my childhood, there's this bird called a curlew. It's so commonplace that none of us think anything of it. It's just a bird that lives in our fields. It's about 18 inches high. It's a sort of slightly dull brown bird, but it's a wading bird from the coast. It has a curved beak. And it comes inland from the coast of Britain to nest in our fields every spring. So it has this beautiful song as it rises and falls above the fields. It has this really, really beautiful song, which is just the most common English rural sound you ever heard. Everybody in England grew up with that sound. It's become symbolic in Britain because it started to disappear and vanish very, very quickly, particularly from the 1990s onwards. Why has that happened? Because of the intensification of grassland. Okay, so you take a field that until in our area, maybe until the 1970s, had been mowed in July for hay. You apply ammonia nitrate, sort of fossil fuel fertilizers to it. You can harvest it. You can cut the grass and you can make it into silage in a clamp. You can do that maybe 6 weeks, sometimes 2 months earlier than you used to make hay, by perpetually putting on artificial fossil fuel nutrients. You may be able to mow that field three times in a season. And what you've done is you're making much better feedstuff for dairy cattle or beef cattle, but you've rendered most of the English landscape an impossible place to nest or hatch chicks. So before the chicks get off the ground or the eggs have hatched, sometimes even now, the mower goes through and decimates them. And yeah, and there's a particularly sad thing about curlews, which is that they're field loyal. They're very loyal to the places where they nest, and they can live for 30 or 40 years. So I tell the story in the book about how this looks to the farmer. So the farmer changes his mowing technology and his fertilizer. Maybe for 20 years after that, the same pair of curlews come back to his land. So he thinks nothing's changed. But every single year, without him realizing it, he's killing the chicks in the sward, in the grass. And then suddenly the curlews are gone. And the link between cause and effect is kind of complicated, right? It's 20 years since he changed his farming technologies, and the kill ewes seem to be doing fine. And then suddenly they're gone and they never come back. They're disappearing. So I think it's true that a couple of years ago, this bird that was once incredibly common, I think there were only five chicks fledged, lived long enough to get off the ground in the south of England below Birmingham, like half of England. And you're like, wow, just on our watch, I'm a 46-year-old man, I'm quite fit, I'm quite young. But in my lifetime, we would tweak things and change things so radically on so much land that one of our most beloved common birds cannot get a chick off the ground anywhere. And for me, they were really, really important because I briefly, in my 20s, thought this was all good, right? Why would you not like a more efficient mower? Why would you not want this chemical that makes the grass grow quicker? Why would you not kill the weeds? These are things farmers always dreamt of. But the curlew for me was one of the waking up moments where you look at your fields and suddenly they're silent and you think, what is this? Like, has anybody thought this through? I remember thinking in my late 20s, has anyone thought this through properly? And it took me a few years to realize actually no one's thinking this through properly. Ecologists sort of in one end of the corridor seeing nothing but disaster and decline. Farmers are at the other end of the corridor trying to feed us more and more productively, cheaper and cheaper. Like, they don't think it's their job to look after a curlew. And yet it seems to me that that's a fundamental flaw. When most of our land is managed for agriculture, how can we really not be responsible for that or pretend we're not responsible? So my book is a very heartfelt story about that, really. And I didn't want to preach at people. This interview is probably a little heavy. I didn't want to do that in the book. I just wanted to tell a story about how people like my dad and my granddad would go along with those things and how people like us would eventually begin to question them and ultimately decide that we don't want to be part of that anymore.
Right. I mean, it does seem your granddad didn't go along with it, but the pressures on your father were intense because everybody else was doing this. And moreover, I was also struck by the fact that, you know, it was very labor-intensive farming that your grandfather did. And you say there was just, you know, there's not enough people to farm in the way that he did. And yet now you have turned back to the old ways. So tell us, you know, what's the back to the future story here? How can we farm in a way that does take care of the curlews, makes a profit, you know, enough to keep farmers afloat and feeds the world?
Okay, so let's start with the bad news. The bad news is you can't turn the clock back to the past in terms of how you manage land, but get paid 2021 prices and expect that to work out well. That's not going to work. So things like the lambs that we sell, or the meat we sell off our lambs, is a quarter of the real price it was when I was born. And things like industrial chicken are something like 10% of the price they were in the post-war period. So something has to change there, right? So it's pretty easy to change how you manage land to make it better. I can very easily drop my mowing dates back. I can very easily put the diversity back into my pastures. I can learn new tricks like letting my pastures have much longer recovery periods, which help the flowers to seed and grow and do their thing. The actual techniques to mend my land, to mend my soil, are not that difficult. You just have to listen carefully to the soil scientists and to the ecologists. And we pretty much know how to do that. So one of the steps on our farm has been to stop fighting people, stop being defensive, because I think farmers around the world feel quite defensive. They feel like they're being got at now by people who don't understand the real difficulties they're facing. On our farm, one of the big steps was to stop doing that. So it was to start inviting ecologists in and saying, all right, talk to me. What do we need to do and how would we do it? But then if I bring it back to the money side, we've been lucky enough until now to be to have various environmental schemes available. They're not as available as I would like, and they don't pay as much as I would like. But we do have some of that in the UK. So we've been able to utilize some of that to make changes. And we've had to diversify a lot on the farm. So we do a lot of education work on the farm to bring people on, particularly children and students. And there's a lot of talk. It hasn't been delivered upon yet, but there's a lot of talk in Britain about paying farmers not just to be business people, or paying them to do the wrong things, as we did for most of the post-war period. And sadly, that's what most of the money going into American agriculture does. But pay farmers instead to be good stewards of the land. And it doesn't all have to be bad news. So what we've been learning recently is if we manage our soil correctly, if we can get enough organic matter into the soil, if we can get these really diverse pastures and meadows, so we have over 200 species of flowers and grasses on our farm, if we can let them do their thing and photosynthesize effectively with much longer rest than we used to have, then we think we can grow something like 30% more biomass. So what we're really doing is we're trading out fossil fuels, which are expensive inputs, which were bankrupting us, and we're trading in a better understanding of photosynthesis and other natural processes which enable us to be here. But if you want me to tell you that there's a magic solution, there isn't really. I think what we have to do as a society is to prioritize good food and farming and nature much more highly. And then we have to start making tough choices about how we want to spend our money. And I know in America, you spend something like 6-7% of your household budgets on food. That's down from 30-something% not many decades ago. And we also know that something like 15 cents in the dollar of your food spend, only 15 cents in the dollar, gets anywhere near going back to farmers. So when we think we're buying food, it must be the money must be going to farmers. 85 cents in the dollar isn't. It's never going anywhere near a farm. It's going to giant food corporations and retailers. So I think we're going to have to start making difficult personal decisions about what we eat and what we spend on it and where we buy. But we're probably going to have to start making difficult political decisions and political choices. And you know, I was just reading recently how sad it is that the big food, big pharma, big ag own both of your leading political parties. They have such a powerful lobbying effect in Washington that it doesn't really matter who wins your elections. You get the same thing. And that ultimately is going to come down to Americans wanting something else and rebelling. Yeah, and the only thing I would say about that is you also have some of the best farmers in the world, best regenerative farmers in the world that I'm learning from. So I'm not coming on here bad-mouthing American farmers. You've got some amazing farmers so that know how to do all of this. So this is not anti-Americanism. There's a good side to American farming as well, and a hell of a lot of good people in American farming that want to do better. They're just in bad systems at the moment.
Well, that is a great point, and I think your book, James Rebank's Pastoral Song, is just a wonderful way to spread that message. It's a deeply affecting story in the sense of the personal story and the connections between you and your grandfather and his connection to the land, and then how you are bringing that back in a way that can show us all how we can produce food in a way that protects our food system and our planet well into the future. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure. And although this interview has been a little heavy, the book is very much about ordinary people. It's about my dad, my granddad, my grandma, my mom, and then my kids, about how we try to put this stuff back together. So thank you very much for having me on. Yeah.
James Rebanks. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Pastoral Song. Next week on Writer's Voice, we spend the hour with inventor and engineer Saul Griffith talking about his book, Electrify, an optimist playbook for our clean energy future. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.